Good morning, everyone. Last week, we discussed the nature of the mitzvah of emunah according to Rambam. And this week, we will discuss the mitzvah of emunah according to other Rishonim and Achronim, principally the Kuzari. Last week, we saw the Medrash. You could see it on page 61 of your source books, if you have the older ones, which describes how Avram Avinu came to a recognition of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The Medrash writes, Amar Reb Yitzchak, Mashal Echad, Shahaya Over Mimakom Lamakom. Imagine a person going from place to place. Parenthetically, why is it significant that Avram is depicted as going from place to place? That doesn't seem to be particularly relevant for the rest of the story. Why doesn't the Medrash simply begin with the fact that Avram had these questions concerning the existence of the world? I once heard from Rav Aaron Lapiansky that this is a reflection of Avram's journey in life. He was going from place to place, looking, seeking, trying to find the truth. We mentioned earlier the Rambam's point that Avram Avinu began questioning how there could be a world without a God at the age of 3, but only came to the firm conviction and conclusion concerning the nature of God's existence by the age of 40. Between the age of 3 and 4, he was growing, he was changing. As the Rambam writes, "Hu haya ovedi maham," he was an oved avodah zarah. So, the Medrash, which depicts Avram as being someone who is going from place to place, perhaps reflects this as well. V'ra'a bira achas dolakas, and he saw an illuminated, or perhaps on fire, bira, a palace. Amar, tomar shehabore shabira zu belo manhig? Is it possible that there is no manhig for this bira? It's interesting to note that the Medrash doesn't say bore, which is sort of what you might have expected, but rather manhig. Here, we're trying to find proof not just for the existence of God, but that he is the manhig of the world, meaning to say he continues to direct the world. It wasn't simply that God created the world and let it be. It's interesting, the Rambam also picks up on this. We mentioned last week that the Rambam's presentation of Avram's coming to an awareness of HaKadosh Baruch Hu seems to be based off of this Medrash, and a reflection of that is the fact that the Rambam, in the beginning of Hilchos Avodah Zarah, uses the word manhig as well, twice, in terms of referring to how Avram came to this awareness. So is it possible that there could be a bira below manhig? It could be as well that the term manhig is very precise. Why does it need to say that the bira is dolakas? Let's assume for a moment that means illuminated. So simply say, ra'a sheyesh bira. The way that the cosmological proof is generally presented is that there can't be a universe without some type of creator. Something must have triggered it, started it, and therefore it should simply say he saw a palace. And he stated that there can't be a palace without a builder. There must have been a builder. The answer is, it's not simply that there's a bira, but there's a bira dolakas. It's not simply that HaKadosh Baruch Hu created the world, but he continues to sustain the world. He continues to give light to the world. I think Rabbi Tursky once added that he sustains it with chesed. It's not just, again, a creator, but a benevolent manhig. So, Avram Avinu sees this bira dolakas, hates its alav bal habira. Amar lo, ani hu bal habira. After having come to the awareness that there must be a God, so then, hates its alav bal habira, then the director, the creator, looks at him and communicates with him and tells him, ani hu bal habira, I am the one who created this all. Kach lefi shaya Avram Avinu omer, tomer sheolam b'lo manhig, hates it alav HaKadosh Baruch Hu, v'amr lo, ani hu bal haolam. Now, This is very significant. The Medrash here tells us that there is a value to seeking proof, and in fact, that is how initially Avram Avinu came to an awareness of the existence of God. However, it does not just end there. It's not just the cosmological proof or the teleological proof, but rather Avram's initial search led him to a conversation with the Almighty. It developed into a relationship. And this brings us to the position of Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, whom we're going to discuss today. Rabbi Yehuda Halevi compares the person who knows God solely based on philosophical proof to a person who has a relationship to God. And in Kuzari's words, they're very different. It's the difference between serving the God of Aristotle versus serving the God of Avraham. What he means to say is that the great innovation of Avraham was not simply the discovery that there is a God, but the discovery that we could have a relationship with God. It's not just God's existence, but it's the possibility for a personal relationship. The Kuzari understands, we'll read it inside in a moment, but just to introduce it first, that this is the difference between the Shem Havaya and Elohim. Elohim refers to God as God. Shem Havaya, when we call God by the Shem Havaya, we're calling him by his name. And that reflects a personal interaction, relationship. You don't just know that something exists as a title, this is God, but you know his name. You call him by his name. That is the Chiddush of Avram Avinu. And that's the difference between the God of Aristotle and the God of Avram. The God of Aristotle is something that, an abstract concept that could be proven to exist philosophically. The God of Avram is a being with whom we have a relationship with. And he notes, for example, that Mesiras Nefesh is only possible with respect to the God of Avram as opposed to the God of Aristotle. L'mashal l'mad davar doma. If a person is absolutely sure that a triangle has 180 degrees, there he has no doubts in his mind. He's 100% sure. And a tyrannical king would arise and say that a triangle actually has 179 degrees. And anyone who does not profess this belief will be executed. So most likely, that's not something that you would be willing to give your life for, even though you're certain that it's true, or you're certain that it's false, because who cares? So a person might very well know that God exists, philosophically speaking, but if it's nothing more than philosophical knowledge, so that's not something that somebody's going to be willing to give their life for. If it's a relationship, so it's something that one is willing to give their life for. And that's why Avraham Avinu was tested in this respect, in Ur Kasdim and the like. Why? Because he was showing that his belief in God went much further than simply philosophical awareness. The way the Akedas Yitzchak puts this, Rav Yitzchak Arama, is the following. V'ulam, I think this is, let's see, it's in the, I hope I put it here. I didn't seem to, I think I left it out of your packet. So just listen. V'ulam yisha'er shehu mehamin hasheni. V'hu kedei sheyotzia minusa shleimuso el hapoel v'yushlam. Here he's talking about the purpose of a nisayon. V'yushlam sechlo v'dato mishnei panim ha'achad. Mitzad ha'inyan ha'mitzvah ha'hi ha'klalis. V'hu sheyotzi uhu balagamre. Mimadregas filosof tiv'i. Lema'alas torani eloki, ki bederach ha-filosofim ein sichlos gedola mizu. The idea of being moser nefesh, of willing to go into a fiery furnace, or to slaughter your son, simply based off of the awareness that God exists from a philosophical perspective, ein sichlos gedola mizu, there could be nothing more foolish. And that is the purpose of Avram's early test. So let's take a look and read it inside. Okay, so again, page 61. Ve'en shem meduyak yoser v'chashuv yoser min hashem hanechbad ba'osios yud hei vav hei yisbarach v'yisromam ze hu shem prati bo romzim le'eloka lo b'toar hamakom k'derech shiromzim l'chol mitu'ar bilti yadua v'lo b'toarim no safim al atzmuso v'lo behachlala kivishem haklali elokim ki im bishem miyuchad lo shekein hu nikra hashem al derech hayichud. And this is a fascinating thing. Most religions, well, I don't know, I don't know much about other religions, but the fact that that we refer to HaKadosh Baruch Hu not as God but as Hashem with a name reflects the very essence of how we relate to him. Again, that we call him by his name. We don't just refer to him as God. Ki'ilu sha'ala shoel, mihu elokim, shi'esh lavdo. Imagine someone asks, who is this God that you should serve him? Hashemesh, o yareach, o shamayim, o mazalos, o achad ha'kochavim, o ha'esh, o ha'ruach, o ha'malachim, o ha'ruchaniyim, o zulasam, ki hu l'chol achad me'ele pe'ula mishalo, v'shilto mishalo, v'chol achad me'em siba l'hisavus, dvarim u'le'afseim. V'al zeh ba'atshuva, Hashem, ki ilu amarta ploni. When we refer to God by name, it's like almost, l'havdil, we're referring to a particular person. V'karasa lo b'shem prati, Ruvain v'shimon l'mashal, b'tanai shal yideh shemos, Ruvain v'shimon, Tivada be'amit atzmusam. And then in the next paragraph he writes, Ve'echekra b'shem yuchad she'en l'rmoz alav ve'lo ra'isi alav mepi'ulosav hi. Amar ha'chaver, yesh v'yesh alav remez be'edos ha'nevua uv'ri'as ha'lev ki be'emes Harayos mat'e umimena noldu haminos v'shilton. Remarkable. Demonstration, meaning to say philosophical demonstration, could lead a person astray. Demonstration was the mother of heresy and destructive ideas. I'd like to elaborate upon this for a moment. We'll just skip a little bit to the next paragraph. Amar Kuzari, Hine nitba'er li hafresh ben Hashemos Elokim v'Hashem, v'avinosi ma rav hamerchak ben Elokei Avraham uvein Elokei Aristo. Ki l'Hashem yis'alem mishtokikim b'nei Adam shehisiguhu b'chush v'al yisod edus ri'ia v'ilu l'Elokim notim al pi hekesh hegyoni. Mi shesigu b'chush balidei mesiris nefesh mitoch avas haloka vilidei hanechonos lamus aleha. This distinction is very much similar to an idea that the Rav develops in The Lonely Man of Faith, where he distinguishes between Adam 1 and Adam 2. The Rav very famously there is addressing the seemingly repetitive and dual creation story. There's a depiction of the world being created in the first chapter, Perek Aleph, and the first three and a half psukim of Perek Beis, and then there's a second creation narrative. And the question is, how are we supposed to relate to these two narratives? Of course, questions of these have been the basis of all sorts of things, such as the documentary hypothesis and the like. No, look, it's two stories, it must be two texts. And the Rav It's interesting, at the beginning of The Lonely Man of Faith, where he deals with that, writes how he was never bothered by the types of questions that the biblical critics asked, these types of questions. He's bothered by a different question, a question that doesn't bother too many people anymore, but that's a different story. But he deals with the issue, and he sets up a model as to how to deal with these types of issues, how to address seemingly repetitive or superfluous narratives in a very powerful and sophisticated manner. And we don't have time today to go into his whole presentation, but essentially he distinguishes between what he calls Adam 1 and Adam 2, or the first person created as depicted in the first chapter versus in the second chapter. And he notes that Adam 1 relates to God in a cosmic sense. He's the cosmic God. Bereshis bara Elohim. God in the first chapter of Bereshis, very much as the Kuzari presented, is referred to not by the Shem Havaya, but Elohim. The difference isn't just Rachamim versus Din, as Rashi explains, but as the Kuzari presents, it's a Toar, Elohim, God, versus a Shem, Havaya. Adam 2, on the other hand, sees God and relates to God as something with a name. He studies the universe, the Rav writes, with naivete, awe, and admiration of the child who seeks the unusual and wonderful in every ordinary event. He looks for the image of God, not in the mathematical formula or the natural relational law, but in every beam of light, in every bud and blossom, in the morning breeze, and the stillness of the starlit evening. Adam 1 uses his practical intellect, his scientific ability to comprehend the forces of nature. He's someone who, in fact, conquers nature. He's, as God instructs Adam 1, to conquer, to be kovesh. But Adam 2, on the other hand, is humble, realizing that he was created from the dust of the earth. He allows himself to be overpowered and defeated by God. Adam 1 retains distance from God, relating merely to the divine endowment of creativity. Adam 2 has a genuine living experience of God and is preoccupied with him, as evidenced by the metaphor of God breathing life into his nostrils, something which is an intensely intimate depiction of creation. Elohim denotes God as the source of cosmic dynamics, while the tetragrammaton indicates personal, intimate communication between God and man. Adam 1 is satisfied by an impersonal counter with the former, i.e. the cosmic experience, while Adam 2 craves the covenantal experience. Essentially what the Rav's doing in The Lonely Man of Faith, and beautifully weaving into the first Prakim of Sefer Bereshis, are these two typologies: someone who serves the God of Aristotle versus someone who serves the God of Avram. And as we saw in the Kuzari, it's not simply that the Kuzari says that there is no place for proof. He in fact notes that, I'll just read a little from the next paragraph. V'yitachen ki ha'iyun hazeh shematzanu b'sefer yitzira hi'iyuno shel Avram Avinu sha'a shekvar nisbaru lo achdus ha'aloka v'ribonoso ach terem zachal hiskalos. Like the Medrash says, before Avram Avinu communicated to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, prophecy is the pinnacle of this relationship aspect of our connection to the divine. Until God spoke to Avram, like the Medrash said, Avram related to God as someone whom he discovered philosophically. Ulam le'achar shezacha lehisgalos. After he was zocha to prophecy, after God spoke to Avram, Azav es kol hakeshim, v'lo bikesh me'im haloka, ki im lios lo l'ratzon. He abandoned all speculations and proofs, and only strove to gain favor to gain the favor of God, there's a transition. Once a person has a relationship with God, so then seeking proof, and the proofs that they may have sought, are of very little value. The Rav also presents this point in The Lonely Man of Faith very powerfully. On several occasions, he quotes from Kierkegaard, the famous Danish theologian, who powerfully makes this point. Kierkegaard, when sarcastically responded when told that Amsalem fasted and spent many days in prayers when looking for rational evidence for the existence of God, so he wrote the following: "Does the loving bride in the embrace of her beloved ask for proof that he is alive and real? Must the prayerful soul, clinging in passionate love and ecstasy before her beloved, demonstrates that he exists?" In other words, it's silly. What is the point in when you're embracing your beloved, so you don't wonder, do they exist? Someone that has a relationship with God, someone that speaks to God, someone that communicates to God, will no longer seek proof. Proof is irrelevant at that point. And thus, after Avraham Avinu communicated with the Kaddish Baruch Hu, so then these types of proofs that might have initially led him to belief were no longer of any value. When one studies the Kuzari, one gets the impression that a major part of this relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu that was initiated with Avraham Avinu was largely based off of prophecy, which leads one to wonder what role it has in the modern world. We, of course, live in a post-prophetic world, and we have to wonder what then is the nature of our relationship to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We no longer have prophecy. And the answer, of course, is that the relationship continues, and even in our world, we continue to intimately encounter God. One powerful way in which this is done is through Talmud Torah, which differs from any other intellectual pursuit. Rav Dessler powerfully writes that the most powerful and definitive proof for the existence of God emerges from the study of Torah. He writes, this is Michtam Eliyahu Chelek Gimel on page 177, and it should be on page 64 of your source books. His alus be'emunah pnimis ba'a al yedei his amkus b'torah atzma. In other words, Talmud Torah be'ion. V'lo al yedei chakiras ha'seichal mufshetes. And I think that for anyone who does engage in serious Talmud Torah, so this is something that they experience, or at least many of us experience. However, Talmud Torah is not the only way to arrive at experiential knowledge of the divine. Many of our everyday experiences lead to this. We'll read about in a moment how Rav Aaron Lichtenstein presents this, but I'd like to first address a question that many people have concerning the experiential awareness that God exists. Some people see this as a cop-out. Since we can no longer prove the existence of God definitively, since Hume and Kant and others have disproved the type of medieval scholastic proofs that we considered last week, so as a second best option, we seek epistemological awareness of God's existence, we seek knowledge of God's existence through experiential means. But this is secondary, it's not as good because it's not as definitive and it's not as clear. So I think that's really incorrect and certainly not what the Kuzari is saying. First of all, as we noted last week, that one could still make a very strong case that from a scientific and philosophical perspective, awareness of God can be achieved. So we don't need this because we don't have anything else. Rather, it's because there is a aspect of superiority to this sort of awareness. I saw recently an interesting point. There was a series in the New York Times about this point, and it was a several part series written by philosopher Gary Gutting. This last piece was entitled "Debating God: Notes on an Unanswered Question," and he interviewed in the previous, I think, 11 pieces, various theologians and philosophers about belief in God. And in the final piece, he was interviewing himself, as it were. I'll just read for you a couple lines, which I think get to the point of what people wonder about this. So, okay, but at least aren't believers who appeal to religious experience and metaphysical arguments admitting what popular atheism so insistently claims, there's simply no evidence for God's existence, and that alone warrants atheism? There's no scientific evidence, but there are other sorts of evidence. Response: I suspect that most atheists think scientific evidence, evidence that ultimately appeals only to empirically observable facts, is the only sort of evidence that there is. Response: that may be their assumption, but how do they show that it's correct? It certainly isn't supported by scientific evidence, since that tells us about only what is empirically observable. The question is whether there is anything else. So this is an important point. In other words, the assumption, which we dealt with earlier, last week, that only empirical evidence is the only good evidence, or this type of experiential evidence is somehow less powerful or less true, is not supported by science. Science doesn't claim that empirical evidence is the only type of evidence. It's simply the only evidence that it deals with. And therefore, a person doesn't have to feel, I believe, intimidated, or that this type of experiential awareness is somehow deficient. And thus, it too can legitimately serve as an epistemological basis for certainty. As I mentioned before, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein has a very powerful piece on this. It's in which he, it's page 64 as well. This isn't the whole piece. It's a snippet, but he discusses the basis for his own personal belief. And his primary claim is the greatest source of faith has been God Himself. He writes, "Encounter, of course, has been varied. In part, it has been channeled, primarily through the learning of Torah, but also through prayer and performance of mitzvos, or, if you will, by the halachic regimen in its totality. In part, it has been random, moments of illumination while getting on a crowded bus or watching children play in a park at twilight. Obviously, it has been greatly varied in intensity. In its totality, however, whatever the form and content, it has been the ultimate basis of spiritual life." I find this so powerful, first of all, in its honesty, acknowledging that there are times in our life where our conviction might be stronger than other times. And there are moments when we're inspired by things that we can't quite explain why we find them so inspiring. Children on a crowded bus, or playing in a park, or the like. Why is it that watching children play brings somebody to a definitive conviction about the existence of God? Well, we can't quite explain that rationally, but that doesn't mean to say that it's not true, and it doesn't mean to say it's not powerful. Now, this of course leads to a problem, which is that experiences only help people who experience them. While using philosophical evidence, you could attempt to prove to someone who doesn't believe that in fact God exists, when it comes to this type of experiential knowledge, so if you have it, great, but if you don't have it, so there's not too much you could do about it. Rav Lichtenstein addresses this problem. He writes, "This will obviously provide little guidance for those to whom attaining encounter is precisely the problem. To those struggling to develop faith, one can, however, prefer first the reassuring assertion of the religious significance of the quest per se, like we saw today with respect to Avraham Avinu. They have already become seekers of God. Second, the prospective hope of successful resolution, as the Lord is good unto those who yearn for him, to those who seeketh him. And third, the counsel to focus persistently in terms of Coleridge's familiar distinction upon faith rather than belief, upon experiential trust, dependence, and submission, more than upon catechetical dogmatics. Intellectual assent is normative and essential, but at the personal level, it is generally not the key. In the final analysis, the primary human source of faith is faith itself." Now, of course, on a practical level, we can seek activities that promote our faith. This is certainly true with someone who already has emunah and is lurking to deepen their emunah. The mitzvah of Enochi is a mitzvah that tells us not just to believe, but to solidify our faith. And that could be done whether seeking proof, philosophical, historical, scientific, or it could be through attending a kumsitz and seeking the types of activities, perhaps a walk in the woods or meditation, the types of activities that will promote this. The Rishonim note, those who do not count Anochi, who do not count Emunah as a mitzvah, that it doesn't make sense that belief should be a mitzvah. After all, if you believe, then you already believe. What's the point of the mitzvah? And if you don't believe, so the commandment to believe will not help. The answer, though, is that there are activities that we could do that will promote and strengthen our belief. And for different people, they might be different activities. The mitzvah of Emunah, though, tells us that we should seek those activities that will help us and look for them. Now, another question that people wonder about concerning experiential awareness is, how do I know I'm not delusional? It's true that I have this feeling of closeness to God, sometimes at a kumsitz, or when davening Kabbalah Shabbos, or the like, but, you know, sometimes I also get a warm and fuzzy feeling when watching a movie, or if it's a, you know, really close football game, and at the last moment there's, you know, how do I know this is real? So Rav Lichtenstein addresses this as well. At the level of rational demonstration, this is, of course, patently circular. I hold no brief for Anselm's ontological proof, and I recognize the theoretical possibility of self-delusion long before I had ever heard of Feuerbach. Me too, I still haven't heard of him. Existentially, however, nothing has been more authentic than the encounter with our Father, our King, the source and ground of all being, nothing more sustaining, nothing more strengthening, nothing more vivifying. I think the answer to this question is twofold. Firstly, at a certain point, we do have to trust our gut. That's the way we, in fact, live our lives. You can question all sorts of things. Am I in this room? Or is this just a delusion? Am I sitting on a chair? Maybe that's also a delusion. Maybe I'm here, maybe I'm not. Maybe you're here. Maybe I'm talking to myself. The fact that we could question whether these are authentic is not as important when we really feel them to be authentic. Second of all, these types of experiences contribute to belief, but they're not its only foundation. These powerful experiences join the myriad of other factors that bring us to belief. When people ask me, why do I believe in God? So one of the things that I think about is that if you ask me, why do I love my wife? The answer is, it's not just this reason or that reason. It's not just, well, let's talk about my wife. She'd be upset if I, but somebody is asked, why do they love their wife? So I say, I don't know, she's nice, she's smart, she's beautiful, she's all sorts of reasons. So first of all, there are many factors to something like love. It's not just one reason. And second of all those factors combine to create something that's much bigger than any of the factors alone. And I think the same thing is true with respect to belief in God. When I think about my own belief, so there are many factors. The extraordinary providence, hashkacha, that I've experienced in my own life. When I think back about how I came to where I am now, and how so many things could have turned out differently, how many times I was hoping that things would be different, and saw only later the Yad Hashem, how he was directing me, in sometimes the most unlikely of ways. When I think about the moral perfection that I see in my teachers and in tzaddikim, when I see in them and how Torah brought them to shlemus in a way that I wouldn't have thought possible. So that too gives me incredible amounts of conviction about the truth of Torah. Look at what Torah could bring a person to become. When I think about the types of scientific questions we talked about last week, when I study history, and especially Jewish history, when I consider the types of powerful encounters and emotional experiences they have at certain points in my life. So I'm left with certainty that he exists, that he's watching, that he's guiding, that he's protecting me. Now it's true that many of these types of things will not be able to convince the skeptic. I experience things in my life, and when I look back at my life, I feel certain things. But that's not going to convince someone else if they don't see it in their life. They don't experience these things, so it's not going to convince them. But and in that sense, you know, if somebody asks, why should I believe? You can't answer that question. You could say why I believe, and hopefully they will be able to find their own reasons why they should believe. But I think that when we put together what we discussed last week in terms of the Rambam with what we're discussing this week in terms of the Kuzari, what emerges is a much more complete picture. That when both of those paths are followed and joined, that's much more powerful than any one particular. I'll take questions afterwards. I just
One additional point that I think emerges from the Kuzari. The Kuzari writes that one of the advantages of experiential proof for God's existence over philosophical proof is that experiential knowledge will prevent a person from being swayed by questions. If someone's knowledge is simply based off of science or philosophy, so then when you have certain scientific questions, one's belief is called into question. However, when it's a relationship, so then all doubts dissipate. One could have a debate with someone, going back and forth. Can a metal box fly or can't it fly? I'll have arguments in favor, you'll have arguments opposed. But when we watch a 747 take off, that it just doesn't matter anymore. It's the debates dissipate. And these types of points relate to very important theological problems as well. You know, it's not just scientific problems, philosophical problems that lead people to question their belief. More than anything else, the Ramban actually writes, it's the problem of evil. In his Hakdama to Sefer Iyov, the Ramban writes, V'yesh davar mach'iv halavavos umad'iv hamachshavos mimenu levado nimshechu kol hadoros lekfira gemura v'hu haros ba'olam mishpat me'ukal v'tzadik v'ralo v'rasha v'tovlo ze shoresh ha'meri b'chol ha'mordim mikol uma v'lashon. It's not so much when you speak to people that struggle with faith, the questions frequently of science, evolution, philosophy, as much as the questions that arise when you see the righteous beaten and the wicked flourish. Unanswerable questions. A child dying, innocent young people with cancer, all sorts of things. These types of questions are very frequently what trouble a person. And the fact that it's frequently an emotional, more than an intellectual question that causes a person to doubt, so that points to the fact that the response has to be on an emotional level and not just simply an intellectual level. Answering the questions, whatever they might be, is often insufficient. And the first thing we have to recognize is that this question, this unanswerable question, is indeed a legitimate concern. It's something that our greatest leaders have struggled with. Yirmiyahu said, Madua derech reshaim tzalecha. Habakkuk asks, Lama tabit bogdim tacharish bivala rasha tzadik mimenu. Koheles complained, Yesh hevel asher nasa al haaretz asher yesh tzadikim asher magia aleim kemasei reshaim, v'yesh reshaim shemagia aleim kemasei tzadikim. And the Ramban notes that these righteous individuals, first of all, though they struggled, they didn't ultimately lose faith. And it's not an intellectual question as much as a cry out. The questions aren't intellectual, but they're pleas, they're cries, they're emotional. So perhaps another time in this year we'll talk about the intellectual responses to the problem of evil. But now I'd like to focus on what the Kuzari points out, which is that when someone's faith is based off of a relationship, so then even though they won't be able to answer the question of why this happened, they will be able to maintain their faith. Just to see this, I think, powerfully, if you take a look at Tehillim, Ayin Gimel, like any sensitive soul, it's page 65. Asaf struggled with the seeming injustice of our world. His emotional turmoil was so powerful. Pasuk Beis, he's nearly swept away. Vani kimat natayu raglai. Why? Ki kinesi beholulim shalom mishaim ereh. the prideful people who steal from the innocent and consume the bounty with their bulgeful and fatty eyes, those who do not worry of divine retribution. After all, Pasuk Yud Aleph, V'amru Eicha Yada El V'yesh Deya Be'elyon. And seemingly, they're right, because they continue to prosper. Yud Daled, Va'ehi Nagua Kol Hayom Etochachti Labkarim. I'm plagued all day by these things. So how does he finally resolve his crisis of faith? Pasuk Yud Zayin. Ad avo el mikdashay el, avina la'acharisam. When I enter the Beis HaMikdash, so then things seem to make sense. The problems dissipate. But how? How is it that simply entering the Beis HaMikdash solves the problem of evil? You still have the question of why do the wicked prosper and the righteous suffer? The answer, as Kuzari explains, is that the Mikdash is the place where we could connect to our Kadosh Baruch Hu. It's where we embrace our lover. We may still not have all the answers, the Kuzari says, but we also don't have any doubts. Evidence to the contrary don't bother us, because we are certain about the truth. Another expression of this is seen in another kapitel Tehillim. David HaMelech says, Nar ha'isi gam zakanti, v'lo ra'isi tzadik ne'ezo, v'zaro mevakesh lachem. At first, it's a very strange idea. I've never seen a tzadik suffer. There are dozens of psukim in Tehillim that discuss the suffering of tzadikim. David HaMelech himself experienced much suffering in his own lifetime. So what does it mean, Lo Ra'isi Tzadik Ne'ezov? The answer is, as we've seen, David HaMelech knew the truth of God's justice and kindness. And accordingly, any sort of evidence to the contrary could not possibly be true. Like Asaf says, after he entered the Beis HaMikdash, Avina La'acharisam, he saw the big picture. What would be in the end? While it's true that immediately before our eyes we see things that might seem to contradict that which we know to be true, but in the end of the day, if our perspective is one of a relationship, one of trust, so these questions will not trouble us. It's fascinating. What caused David HaMelech to say these types of statements? Kfirim Rashu V'Ra'evu V'Darshei Hashem Lo Yachzru Chol Tov. When did David HaMelech come to that conclusion? He came to that conclusion, if you look at the beginning of that kapitel, B'Shanoso Estamo Lifnei Avimelech V'Yigarshei V'Yelach. David HaMelech had to feign madness for his life to be saved. He was drooling like a fool because otherwise he would have been killed. He was running away from Avshalom. His life was seemingly terrible. And yet, in that moment of desperation, when he did ultimately get something to eat, he was able to realize Ein machsor li'reiv. So like we said last week at the end, ultimately these types of questions, how we resolve them, will depend very much on our perspective. If one has trust, then even when presented evidence to the contrary, they will not be troubled. And yet, if one lacks trust, one will always see evidence to the contrary. We're almost out of time, and I do want to take some questions. I'm just going to give you one or two additional marimakomos on perspectives on emunah relating to what we did today, and then I'll take the questions. We don't have time to develop these ideas, but one is the idea of Rav Kook. Rav Kook also develops the idea that we've been discussing, that there are two paradigms for arriving at Emuna. There's proof and there's tradition. And Rav Kook writes that they're both valid, Elu ve'elu divrei Elokim chayim, but there is superiority to the approach of Rav Yehuda HaLevi. Rav Kook here isn't just comparing proof versus tradition, which is the way that the Chakira is sometimes set up by thinkers, but rather he writes that the superiority to the Mahalech of the Kuzari over that of philosophy is that the question is it arriving at the truth from within, or is it coming from outside? Things like the cosmological proof or the like are coming from outside. I look at nature. I look at something outside of me and come to an awareness of the existence of God. Whereas proof that comes from within, what he calls Yashra Salev Vinitiya Yashara, that type of intuition and intuitive approach is something much more powerful. In that sense, it's actually very interesting, because if you just believe in God because you were told it's so, tradition in that sense, so it has that same chisaron, it's not coming from within. However, if that fosters this intuition, so then one has achieved the higher madrega. And likewise, if the philosophical proof also fosters that, one has reached a higher level. Another fascinating point, again, very bekitzer, could be found in the Baal HaTanya. The Baal HaTanya, as well as other Hasidic thinkers, refer a lot to emuna pshuta, simple faith. And when you read the Baal HaTanya, you see that simple faith is not necessarily simplistic. However, it is something that's available to those who are simple, even those who haven't studied philosophy or Kabbalah or the like. And the idea is that a simple person understands things or accepts things without understanding them. They're used to it. They're not the type of person, sort of going back to the Adam II typology, that seeks to understand why things work. That's not their interest. They see it works, so they accept it. Other people seek to understand why and how. How do we know? When it comes to the understanding of God, the more we try to understand Him, the more we're bringing Him down to our level of cognition. Meaning to say, we can't understand Him. We can't understand His essence. The person who tries to will inevitably fail. But in the attempt, they will limit God to what their own brain can comprehend. However, the person with emuna pshuta, who doesn't try to understand, who simply believes, so their conception of God is far truer than someone sophisticated who tries to understand God and thereby limits His nature. The Rav, I guess that's the final Mar Makom for today, as I mentioned earlier, writes a lot about this, a lot about the question of proof. In Halachic Mind, he writes that philosophical arguments are pretty pointless because they're generally presented to two classes of people and effective for neither. They're either presented to the skeptic or to the believer. However, they don't usually convince the skeptic, and the believer doesn't need them anyway. And that's why he develops other aspects. But at the same time, the Rav does write, and again, we don't have time to present it today, but the Rav does write that there is a he offers, I think he tries to offer, a philosophical demonstration that it is in fact rational to believe in God. And he describes and depicts a type of ontological awareness, the subjective consciousness that a person experiences when being in the presence of God, that he thinks forms the basis of a philosophically justifiable basis for belief, and develops that idea. All right, I guess we'll stop here. I'll take some questions. Yeah. That's true, and it's certainly not in our position to judge anyone, and certainly not someone who, like you're describing, has had these terrible experiences. The process of coming to faith is something that's different for everybody, and we can think about and even discuss our own experiences, like Rav Lichtenstein does in that article. But what will help for other people and what other people are capable of, especially in terms of the experiences that they went through, is something that we can't really answer. There are some people that live a life full of suffering, and that brings them closer to God. There are people that, you know, my grandfather told me that living through the Holocaust brought him to unshakable faith that I saw in him. And there are others, of course, who had the opposite experience. All we could do is try to help people and perhaps describe our own belief. But you can't, when dealing with, like you're correctly pointing out, things like experience and experiential awareness, you can't convince anybody. Nobody's going to believe in God because of the experiences that you have. It has to be their experiences.
Also, like the whole story of you is experiential belief.
Very much, yeah.
I thought that one of the ideas Huzar were planning a more experiential.
The Huzar.
Planning it's more experiential, being in the base of Middash, seeing it. Uh-huh. Everything else dissipates. But what about the idea that when he explains that everyone was out Mount Sinai, it's not like we would be lying to each other from generation
Good.
To generation.
She says that.
That seems like a...
That's correct. It is a proof, intellectual, rational, absolutely. This goes back to a distinction that we made last week as well, which is the difference between belief in God and the belief in Torah Mi-Sinai. It's in the context of belief in Torah Mi-Sinai that the Guzari makes that point. And that's something that doesn't necessarily have the same experiential factors. So
we could flip it, or we could say that was Mamash, like, the
It's true for those who experienced it.
But they were connected, though.
They are connected. Yeah. And obviously, if you believe in Torah Mi-Sinai, then you believe in God. But you're absolutely correct. The Guzari has both, and he offers both, and he thinks that there are values in both. But I think specifically the parts that we read today were more about belief in God as opposed to belief in Torah Mi-Sinai, and as we saw last week as well, the Rambam himself distinguishes between the two. He offers a very different type of proof for God than he does for proof of Torah Mi-Sinai.
And does Rambam bring both those ideas, that when he gets the idea for proof and experience them?
I think so. I don't know. Rav Kook doesn't usually tell you where he's getting his ideas from. But you definitely hear echoes of the Kuzari in reading these passages from Rav Kook, as you do from the Rav. Yeah.
So when you talk about the
Ari
Sinatani, you've always said, are you claiming that the other Hamelas was able to see the truth that, in fact, that if there was someone who was Nezav, there's no one who could have Nezavid?
No. That is not necessarily what he's saying. He's saying that lo ra'isi tzadik ne'azov. He had firm conviction about the truth of God's justice and beneficence and the like, which means that lo ra'isi tzadik ne'azov. And that's something that he himself experienced. Even when he experienced feelings of abandonment, he didn't feel abandoned. Now, how is it that that's true? So that's a question. And I don't know how David HaMelech answered the question. And that is an important question. That's not the question we dealt with today. Another time we could talk about it. Why is it that the righteous suffer? And is it true that all suffering is a result of sin? And is there such a thing as suffering that's not a result of the sin that a person has done and the like? That's not the question that we were dealing with today. What I was pointing out is that David HaMelech himself experienced that. Even when he experienced a state of that I think most people, almost anybody, would have felt abandoned, a position of incredible desperation, he himself felt, Lo Ra'isi Tzadik Na'azov. And when a person, I think my understanding of what the Kuzari was saying was that when you have a certain type of relationship and trust, even when you see evidence to the contrary, you know the truth of your convictions. Now, the answers to the question you might not know. And the answer isn't necessarily what you're saying, which is, he's not a tzaddik. There might be other answers, as we'll see when we discuss that. So, if the only answer is, Lo Ra'isi Tzaddik Na'azov, that someone who is abandoned is not a tzaddik, so then you would be right. But as we'll see when we discuss the matter, that isn't the only answer.
Also, isn't the experiential proof, at least as I'm sitting here, trying to claim many more things about God than, you know, a rational philosophical proof?
Indeed.
Which make it a weakness, because in your experiential proof, you're assuming God is this beneficent being who would not have a side of being as and wouldn't...
I don't know why that would be a weakness. I would have thought that's a strength.
It's more ambitious.
But yes, it is more ambitious. It's true. And in that sense, I think it's much more true. But you're correct.
Because if God is supposed to be good, then you weren't this problem which was mentioned before. It's kind of, not the best system we were expecting everyone to believe. But again, their belief will only be based on if they had a nice life.
I wouldn't agree with. I don't think it has to do with having a nice life. I think that
totally subjective to the person.
That's true. Yeah. It is subjective, but it doesn't have to do with having a nice life. There are a lot of people that are very firm believers that didn't have nice lives. There are lots of people with nice lives that didn't have.
No, I agree. It shouldn't have a nice life, but it's totally subjective. We're expecting everyone to believe in something which they believe on a totally subjective basis.
Indeed, I think that is part of what the Torah expects of us. All right, this is a good conversation that could go on for a long time, but alas, we're out of time, so thank you very much, and we'll pick up next week.